What does it take to be an entrepreneur, and how is it changing in our ever-evolving business landscape? This is Scott Galloway, host of the Prop G Podcast and an entrepreneur myself. Right now, we've got a special three-part series running all about the future of entrepreneurship. We're answering your questions on work-life balance, how to raise capital for your business, and more. Because when you're an entrepreneur, it's always important to look ahead at what's to come. So tune in to the Future of Entrepreneurship, a Prop G Pod special sponsored by Mercury. You can find it on the Prop G Pod feed or wherever you get your podcasts.
First thing in the morning, as soon as you wake up, the to-do list starts.
Does the car need gas? Hopefully those leftovers are still good.
Why did I get CC'd on this email?
No.
You can't escape the to-do list, but you can make the most of your me time with a relaxing shower using Method hair care products. Try Pure Peace Volumizing, Simply Nourish Moisturizing, or Daily Zen Shampoo and Conditioner for daily use. All formulated with long-lasting fragrances and are safe for color-treated hair. Reconnect with the best version of yourself. Visit methodproducts.com to unleash your inner shower.
Hello, and welcome to Good One, a podcast about jokes. I'm your host, Vulture Senior Editor, Jesse David Fox. Each episode, a comedian comes on to play a clip of one of their jokes and then discusses how they wrote it and how it fits into what they're trying to do with their comedy. This week's guest is Hannah Gadsby. Starting comedy in 2006, Hannah came up in the Australian system of putting together a new hour set every year. Each would be called quirky things like Kiss Me Quick, I'm Full of Jubes, or Happiness is a Bedside Table. But it's fitting that a decade later, she went with a proper noun, because Nanette took on a life of its own, starting off by winning the top prizes at the Melbourne Comedy Festival and Edinburgh Fringe Festival in 2017, to its release on Netflix in 2018, which garnered it an Emmy and a Peabody, all while becoming the most discussed special in the States since, I'd say, Chris Rock's 1996 breakthrough Bring the Pain. Internationally, it was probably the biggest special ever. But to Hannah, who has for years pushed back on the idea of genius, thinking of it not as a person but an event, a culmination of zeitgeist, that was all Nanette. Nanette was the one who pushed back on the idea of jokes specifically, in how they fail to tell the totality of the story, which leaves the audience off the hook in confronting the reality of the teller's trauma. In that, Nanette probably made its strongest case against self-deprecation, saying, "To be self-deprecating when you're already someone who lives in the margins is not humility, it's humiliation." By deliberately foregoing laughs to make audiences sit with stories of sexual assault and abuse, Nanette questioned comedy. In turn, much of comedy debated if Nanette even counted as stand-up. As Hannah acknowledges, though she created Nanette in relative obscurity, though she was quite well known in Australia, Nanette was toured and released during the height of the first push of the Me Too movement, at a time when audiences were most ready to receive it, be it positively or negatively. Comedy is often a matter of timing. But then what does Hannah do next? It's a question that's even harder to answer when you consider the sort of special Nanette was, a special where she not only said she was going to quit comedy, but also one where she spent the majority of it confronting comedy, questioning its ability to capture all she wanted to say and all she needed to say. So meet Douglas. Named after one of her dogs, it recently came out on Netflix. In it, Hannah mostly tried to be, I hope you're sitting down, really funny. It has like a ton of jokes. And more. For example, there is some structural inventiveness, including that she starts the show laying out exactly everything she's going to talk about during the hour. It's hard to say the special's about one thing, but as Hannah and I discuss, it's largely about showing you how she thinks the way she does, and then trying to explain why, as she tells the story of her autism diagnosis. As she puts it, it's meant to be a romantic comedy. The clip from Douglas we're going to play is a story Hannah tells about what it was like growing up with autism before she knew she was on the spectrum, as Hannah wasn't diagnosed until later in life, not coincidentally enough, right before she started working on Nanette. So, here is Hannah Gadsby.
I have what's called high-functioning autism, which is a terrible name for what I have, because it gives the impression that I function highly. I do not. To give you an idea of what it feels like to be on the spectrum, basically it feels like being the only sober person in a room full of drunks, or the other way around. Basically, everyone is operating on a wavelength you can't quite key into. I remember going from being the teacher's pet to being the teacher's nemesis in one lesson. And until I was diagnosed, I never understood what had happened. Now, the lesson was on prepositions, so strap yourselves in for this story. Now, I do like my teacher. She's a good teacher. I like the way she explained things, but we lost each other this way. This is how she began the lesson. She said, imagine a box. And I could do that. I was gifted to a point. Visual thinker, good box, solid, three-dimensional, nothing fancy, but there. And then she said, a preposition is a word that explains your relationship to the box. And that's when my thinking just fell apart because I thought, I'm related to a box? And then she said, now, you can be behind the box. Does anybody know what the preposition is there? No, they didn't, but I had a question. I said, am I made of box? Now, let me bring you into my thinking there. I thought if I was related to a box, we must share DNA. And it made more sense in my head that I would be made of box than the box would be made of me. But my teacher was not privy to that gifted train of thought circling my head there. So she was a bit thrown. And she said, no, Hannah, you're not made of box. I'm surprised you had to ask that. I said, okay, you can be in front of the box then. Does anybody know what the preposition is there? No, they didn't, but I had another question. I said, does the box have a name? I thought if I had a name, I could work out how we were related. Maybe we were cousins. And she said, no, it's a box. Boxes don't have names, Hannah. What boxes do you know have names? And I started listing breakfast cereals. Like, all right, okay. You can be beside the box. Does anybody know what the preposition is there? No, they didn't, but I had another question. Now, I don't remember my thinking behind this question, but I remember asking it because when I did, everybody laughed and I had no idea why. But I remembered really liking the feeling. Uh-oh. This was the question. I said, am I allowed to eat the box? Of course, yes. Everybody is laughing except me and the teacher looking back. I don't know why the fuck she wasn't laughing. As far as jokes go, that's a classic. A baby dyke just asked if she was allowed to eat the box. She didn't think it was funny. She's like, okay, all right, okay. Shh, 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 shh. Calm down. Okay, we might be on the wrong track. How about we imagine something else in relation to the box then? Okay, how about a penguin? Now, the penguin can be inside the box. Does anybody know what the preposition is there? No, they didn't. But I had some fucking questions about the penguin. I said, what is the penguin made of? And that was the question that broke my teacher. You know you've broken a teacher when a teacher who never swears, swears bad. So I said, what's the penguin made of? And she's like, the penguin? I mean, it's made of fucking penguin. And as far as answers go, that's mwah. Like, that is watertight. That is a stunning answer. You can't logic out of that answer. That is a good answer. But it was at that point I thought, oh, I might be on the wrong track. But I had other questions pressing, but I thought, now doesn't seem the time. She seems upset. So what I thought is I might hang on to my question. That's what I thought. And that was my mistake. I should have either asked my question then while in the thick of it or not at all. Because I did the worst possible thing. I waited until she felt safe. Then I asked my question. But I waited so long it wasn't even the same lesson. It was much later in the day in silent reading. I waited so long it wasn't even a question anymore. It was more of a theory. And that made it worse. I said, what if the penguin ate the box? Wouldn't then you say the penguin's a little bit made of box? Get out. And that was the first but not the last time I was sent out for reasons I had no idea why. Because the thing is, I was genuinely engaged in that lesson. Like, I really wanted to know what a preposition was. It wasn't like I was sitting there going, prepositions? I've never fucking heard of them! But as she explained to me later, she said, you're being deliberately obtuse. I'm like, but I'm not a triangle. I did not learn what a preposition was that day. Look, I understand what they are now. I'm all over it. And I also understand if the penguin ate the box, the penguin would be around the box.
I am here with Hannah Gatsby. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. You're not really here, though, are you?
I am here in the ears of the prospective listener.
Cool.
So, before we talk about your latest special, Douglas, and the joke that we're going to be talking about, I wanted to provide a little background and context. You have said you were diagnosed with autism a few years ago. And, you know, even before Nanette, however, in Australia, you were known for being able to be very personal on stage. You have talked about certain struggles with mental illness before. What was your thought process after you were diagnosed about whether to talk about it on stage? And as you obviously did not include it explicitly in Nanette, decide not to talk about it right away?
Well, I decided not to talk about it because I had talked about other, you know, episodes in my life where I'd struggled with depression, anxiety, and other bits and bobs, we'll call it. And and I found that, people feel very free to offer medical advice, you know, like busking with psychology busking. And what I worked out through trial and error is that's actually really dangerous if you're feeling vulnerable. So, you know, for one show, for example, I talked about how I decided to stop taking antidepressants. And I didn't decide to stop taking them because I don't believe in them. I just sort of, you know, forgot to take them when I was traveling overseas and thought, gosh, maybe now's the time. It's a great way to, you know, come off meds is when you're away from your support network and your doctors. So I sort of talk about it, talked about it and around it, and then people would say, it's the right decision. Drugs are bad. And what I found is through performing that show that, like, while I was good when I wrote it, I increasingly became bad. But I kept hearing drugs are bad and I thought I don't need to go back on them. And it's those little voices, particularly with medication and mental illness and the stigma around that, people get inside your head. And when you're not well, you don't have the tools of discretion and, self-care. So, you know, I delayed getting the medical help I needed to, and it was quite a dangerous place. And as far as, you know, autism is concerned, it's not mental illness. It's a neurobiological situation. Mm-hmm. There are comorbid situations because of the anxiety and stuff that goes around that, which was where my previous sort of struggles were stemming from, and I didn't understand that. So the diagnosis was a really great moment for me because it's like, oh, I don't have to understand why, you know, there's nothing wrong with me. Well, I mean, everything's wrong with everyone, but a lot of my anxieties and issues I found I was better able to, control or manage through environmental adjustments. So, and then I stopped feeling, you know, the guilt about being, I'll call it antisocial, but it's not really antisocial. I'm very social in theory. I started managing my environment better through, you know, understanding the neurobiological bent to it. But also, I don't understand autism. Nobody really understands autism. I had to work out, you know, where do I begin and and where does autism end? And, you know, ultimately the answer to that is there's no such line. It's the flavor. It's how you process the world. But when I first was diagnosed, I didn't understand that. And, you know, I had to live with it and understand it. So it would have been dangerous for both me and the world if I'd have gone out and go, here's autism. This is what I know. So I made it. That's a lot. That's pretty much in a very large nutshell.
You have said that at the time that answer of the autism diagnosis freed you up to, at least for a time, not to look as much as the problem was inward and much more focus on the problems outward. That said, on I think Conan's podcast, you describe Nanette as a show about how a person with autism thinks. And I mean, obviously you can say that hypothetically about anything you've done, but what do you mean in terms of Nanette? In what ways do you think that special exhibits an autistic line of thinking or way of perceiving?
Well, it's specific to me. I wouldn't like to imagine.
Sure.
Yeah, but it's the connecting the macro with the micro is one way. You know, my personal didn't match up until I understood the external, but I always ran under the assumption that the world made sense and I was wrong and I didn't make sense and I had to work out how to make sense in order to fit into the world. It was not long after the diagnosis that, you know, I started to trust my, you know, if something doesn't make sense to me, it's almost painful. And so I take sort of like, you know, the love of misogyny. we just need to sort of name it. And so that was pretty much what I meant by that. It's like I looked at the world not trusting it as much as I had before. And it's sort of a combination of the two. It's like I don't understand myself and I don't understand the world and I never will. And while that's both a horribly frustrating idea to a brain like mine, it also has like a peace valve because it's like, you know, it feels good to try and make sense of things. That's how I operate. That's how I feel calm. But knowing that I can never do it is a good thing.
You wrote Nanette, at least at the beginning, you wrote in one context. You were well known in Australia and in the UK. So the audiences you're performing for at first had a certain frame of reference for you and your work. Mm-hmm. And also this was a show done at first for the Melbourne Comedy Festival, which has its own sort of context in which people are expected to do these sort of shows that are sort of thematically connected. And then it comes out in Netflix, as we Americans tend to do. We sort of defined this thing against ourselves and it became judged in relationship to American comedy. What did you learn about Americans' understanding and thinking about comedy from that moment, from it being received by us?
That you're, like all world leaders in any time in history, incredibly arrogant.
Sure.
It's just that I just think that's human. It's not American. That's just sort of like you don't have to think about the rest of the world because you are, as far as you're concerned, the rest of the world. You think comedy began in America and you drive how it is. And to a certain extent, you do flavor comedy because, you flavor most Western culture. But it does have to go be processed by the other places. So, I'm well aware of American culture and that gives me kind of an edge because you're not at all clued in to the specifics of mine. And so that just gives, I think it's interesting. I think American comedy could do with a bit of a shake up, but that's because I think any creative, standard should be given a shake up. I was surprised at the hostility though, because it's comedy and how seriously people take it is just incredible. It's just like everything is funny except comedy. It's like, come on, guys, get over yourselves.
It made me think of something, a quote from an American comedian, Moshe Kasher, that he said that stand-up comedians, at least in America, are so insecure that what they do can even be considered an art form that they push back against anyone who asserts to do it differently. I think as a person, famously with an art history background, what do you think about this idea that part of it is that it's coming from a certain insecurity that you're questioning sort of what a lot of American comedians were holding true is like, well, if this is the standard and if I'm doing what the standard is, that means I'm doing something that is legitimate. And you sort of put a sort of a question mark over all of that.
Yeah, I'm always kind of amused by people who, you know, sort of think comedy's different to any other anything else, part of why I wrote Nanette was that connection I saw between sort of early modern art and comedy as I saw it and experienced it. And that is that sort of like they broke everything in modern art. They're like all the rules are out except the sort of painting naked women. Like they broke everything except the creepy part. And and so with stand-up, there's that same thing. It's like freedom of speech. We can say anything. We are the last line of free speech. And I'm like, why are you wasting that free speech on dick jokes, you stupid idiot? There's this mistake. It's just like, I think it's a mistake where people think, someone questioning your politics is the same as, authoritarianism. It's like, I say a thing, I think you're wrong. You're silencing me. No, it's a conversation. But I think there's a danger in stand-up comedy because it is so one way that's perhaps a habit of communication with stand-ups.
Yeah.
They're like, they talk at people. That's what we do. We talk at people. And so social media has opened up this conversation that, we're not trained to have. So that one-way aspect of it is, I think, unsettling.
How did learning this affect how you approached or even just how you felt about the idea that, this was going to, with your next show, this is going to be your first time to really sort of tour the States?
Oh, it's been fun. Your American audiences are really lovely. My audiences are not necessarily stand-up comedy audiences. So I'd like, if there are any sort of comics listening to this who are angry at me because I might have stolen a slice of their audience pie. No, people who like what I do hate you. So they never went to comedy because it was, a lot of women don't like feeling unsafe in a crowd. It's just a thing. So I think, I've clearly just found my audience and they're lovely and I had a really nice time. And I paid out on Americans. Like, I didn't exactly hold back on y'all. But it's not because I don't like you. I think you're really nice.
Thank you. For all Americans, I say thank you.
Yeah, you're coming from a good place.
So let's talk about Douglas. So in Melbourne, like Edinburgh, you're coming out of a system where you are expected to do a new thematically connected hour every year. And you've also said that though the idea of quitting comedy meant different things at different times while working on Annette, at least at minimum, it often meant just sort of dislodging yourself from the sort of the pace and pressure of that hour of a year system. This is all to say, when coming up with an entire show, like this, unlike in the States where you just sort of start touring and you build incrementally, but where you're actually sort of like thinking of the show first. So for Douglas, what does that thinking look like? How much are you figuring out just sort of in the conception stage? What are you sort of determining before you even start performing it?
It just made me chuckle because it was just like, that's an art form, guys. See, I haven't broken it. I always think it's important to frame a show about what you're thinking about because, if you frame it about what you think other people are thinking about, for someone like me, that's a fool's errand because I don't think about things in the same way as other people. That's the nature of neurodiversity. But so I pick, the things that are big in my life and then flesh it out around that. I think a lot about structure. I have a very visual brain and with Nanette, I used the framework of callback as a device and then I subverted it. So a callback is, of course, when you you have a little pepper, a little joke up the top, and then later on when you keep referring to it, it gets funnier and funnier. And out of context, it's not necessarily funny. It's just building that language with an audience. But with Nanette, I did that, but instead of making the callback funnier, I made it, you know, devastating, and that was the device I used. In Douglas, I decided to experiment with the call forward. So, yes. Which is dumb, but I thought, oh, well, I'm in this silly position now where I suddenly have a huge audience I didn't intend on or think I'd have, so let's play. And so I, at the beginning of the show, I just, you know, I pepper things that aren't funny when I say them, but then it's like becomes repetition of language. And I used the basic structure of a fugue. So it has the prelude, and then, you know, I have several ideas that, you know, it's clearly not musical because it's spoken, but, you know, I use sort of the way I frame an idea. So I use story, and then I just use rants, and then the story, and then I connect them all. And so, you know, that was really fun to play with. And so as the material built, I sort of like had the framework in which to hang it. And it was a really, really fun way to do a show for me, because usually, you know, the pressure of a festival is kind of difficult because I get very overwhelmed by my environments. And while traveling is very overwhelming, you know, a festival environment is a real killer, as much as I like the theory of them. So being able to just, it was a real privilege to be able to work on a show like this and tour it to, you know, audiences who are clearly wanting to be there. And that's a thing I don't think many successful comedians talk about, is how much easier it gets. Like, comedy is so easy when people are into you.
Well, I think there's certain comedians who dislike that about it. I think there's a type of comedian that, especially at least here, that's like, oh, when audiences like you too much, it's too easy. You want to have to like convince them of a joke, because then you know it's sort of bulletproof or whatever they would say.
Yeah, I don't know. I've struggled for so long. I'm enjoying it.
Yeah,
you know, that's fair. Like, I go through life where, you know, a lot of my early life was like going into an open mic room. I don't need to recreate that on stage. I just want to go back and add on that, the easiness of the audience. I think it's really important to acknowledge that the audience are part of the show. Like, a show only works because of the audience, and a joke isn't bulletproof on the page. Like, jokes don't exist on the page, like in stand-up comedy. You have to perform them, and you don't perform them to a vacuum. And I really don't think it's a smart way to go about it, going, you know, because you get to see so many comedians get really angry at audiences who don't laugh at their jokes, and it's like, that's funny. It's like, yeah, not today.
Yeah.
And the way I've always worked is that, you know, and the way that Douglas evolved, you know, as I toured, it was the stuff that worked in the beginning began to not work, and that was as much about the way I delivered it as also, you know, the context that it was placed in, and the audiences that sort of received it. And you know, while I don't necessarily listen to direct feedback and take it on board and, you know, a literal level, I really do take the audience feedback. So if jokes begin to not work, you know, that's how you understand. If a joke is bulletproof, that's a very club comedy idea, and that's fine. Club comedy exists, and it's a good thing. But I don't like, there's very little of my shows that I can take out and do in a club, and that's you know, that's not because I can't do that. I just don't like doing it. I hate short form comedy. For me personally, I don't mind other people doing it. Get on with it. Go for it. Cool story. But if you think about it, you know, if you use like an athletic comparison, you know, there's sprints, there's longer runs, and there's marathons. And I really enjoy, you wouldn't know looking at me, but I enjoy a marathon.
Is it because you can create the context in which the comedy is existing, opposed to the club, which the club is the context?
Yeah, and that's nothing to do, like, that's not to say clubs are wrong. It's just like my particular brands of autism means that they're actually really incredibly difficult places for me to be in.
You mentioned a little bit about your relationship with the audience. I wanted to ask you a little bit more about that. In the TED Talk you did last year, you explained that there's this sort of contradiction of how you're able to be so good at something you're so bad at, which is talking to people. You say that typically it's hard for you to think, listen, speak, and process new information at the same time. But you can do it in comedy because you don't have to think. You prepare everything you say well in advance. You don't have to listen. That's what the audience does. You're not really talking, you're reciting. So all is left is connection. So, but while working on material, which, you know, is a thing comedians doing constantly, how do you relate to the audience where, as you said, the feedback is essential to sort of understanding what the show is?
I'm incredibly sensitive to my environment, and I think that translates into literally reading a room. And while on interpersonal conversations, I'm not very good at reading a room, but in a large audience, like, I really get a sense of what is working and what is not, and that's what it is. Like, if you think about it in terms of, say, a microphone, it's not because a conversation is like when I miscues and things like that, it's not because my microphone itself is not picking things up. It's set to such a sensitive frequency. Mm-hmm. So it's picking up everything. And I, particularly with sound, vibe, like I know when something's wrong, but all the input I'm struggling to sort out and prioritize. So, mm-hmm. you know, just with sound, if there's a dog barking in the distance, it, to my brain, it's given the same importance as the person I'm talking to. Mm-hmm. I can manage it. You know, I'm not a monster. I go, you know, if someone's pouring their heart out to me, I don't sit there and go, the dog's barking. You know, I get it. But it's actually a really difficult thing. But in a large room, you know, when there's this massive, you know, humanity sitting there and responding to it, it's been a real source of connection for me in my life, because I have been incredibly isolated because of the said dog barking situation. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, has, you know, given me that's part of why I'm good at what I do.
So when we say writing for comedians, it always means something different. When you're writing your material, what does that mean? Is it literally a thing that you're typing? Is it a thing you're writing handout? Or is it sort of an outline? Sort of how are you sort of developing the sort of actual material that we call the material?
It stretches out over time. I use various, depends on what part of the process I'm at. You know, in the beginning, before I've gone on, I'm working on the overall shape and idea of the show more than the actual specifics. I work, you know, there's that famous idea of, you know, I'm not comparing myself to Michelangelo, I'm comparing myself to his process. But sure. He has he gets a slab of marble and then he has to work from that. Whereas, you know, maybe the other process is if you're working up through the clubs and doing 15-minute sets, and that's more, say, a Rodin way of working, where he's shaping, mm-hmm. you know, out from so I chip away at it, and that means I employ different tools at different times. So sometimes I'll sit and try and craft a turn of phrase, you know, on with pen and paper. Other times, you know, I really find the toppers on stage. You know, a joke will be working, and then once I'm comfortable with a joke, my mind then just, because it's always, the way it works is it's always reaching out, trying to find connections, and that's where I get my, you know, the real delightful tags at the end of my jokes. Or mm-hmm. They're never written. They're always found on stage.
Did you go into it knowing, big picture, these are the things you want to hit? Like, obviously, the autism is part of it. It's not only about it, but obviously, you don't just only talk about autism. That actually makes up a very small part of the show. But that is sort of a framing device of what you're trying to have the audience take from it. Is that also something that is developing over time, or is that something you're like, big picture, this is, I know it, I want it to look like this structurally, I know it wants to have this, and I want this sort of to be the takeaway?
What I was, there's two main ideas in it, and it's like I had to deal with an Annette issue, and I had to, you know, I wanted to share autism, and the autism thing is tricky because it's so, people don't know much about it. You know, they think they know what it is, and it's, there's a lot of bad myths out there. But also I didn't want to get up on stage and teach autism. I wanted the show to be autism. And there's, I think people who have autism will get a lot more out of the show and understand that in ways. And I think it's just a step in, you know, I don't think this is the end of how the change of how most people understand autism. You know, it's going to take a long time. But I think, and that was a really difficult thing to do because, you know, how do you do autism without teaching it? I mean, you know, like it's a really difficult juggle. And the show got sillier and sillier as it progressed. So it did start off where I was teaching autism and it was a bit heavy-handed in places, and that was fine. It was part of the process. And then I got to the point where I felt like I, you know, like the preposition thing, it was just like, that's about as close to teaching autism as I got. But the rest of it was, you know, this is the way I think. And it's not that different to the way other people think. It's just the intensity is different. And the Nanette thing was, you know, I sat down writing this and now, well, people are always going to just see me through the lens of Nanette, and that's just the way it's going to be. So I set up camp in the shadow of Nanette and thought, let's make this nice. Mm-hmm. And also different. I wanted people to understand that their trauma doesn't have to define you. Mm-hmm. And there is life after trauma. There is fun after trauma. You know, like life does go on, and you have to exist in the life that goes on. Trauma just keeps pulling you back. But that's not the only thing I have to talk about. And so that was kind of a thing I wanted to achieve.
We will be right back with more Hannah Gatsby.
Vacations can be tricky. You already know how to book flights and hotels, but now the only thing you're missing is, you know, the actual travel experience. Because is it really a vacation if you're just sitting around like you would at home? You need a tool to get the most out of your time away. That's where Viator steps in. You can book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected. And 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
What does it take to be an entrepreneur, and how is it changing in our ever-evolving business landscape? This is Scott Galloway, host of the Prop G Podcast and an entrepreneur myself. Right now, we've got a special three-part series running all about the future of entrepreneurship. We're answering your questions on work-life balance, how to raise capital for your business, and more. Because when you're an entrepreneur, it's always important to look ahead at what's to come. So tune in to the Future of Entrepreneurship, a Prop G Pod special sponsored by Mercury. You can find it on the Prop G Pod feed or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back with Hannah Gatsby. So let's dive deeper into the penguin story. what is your history with this memory? You know, where did it live before your autism diagnosis, and then sort of how did it change after? And then how did you eventually think, oh, we should maybe talk about it on stage?
Look, that was before the diagnosis. That memory lived in kind of a really shameful place. because it's a sort of memory that doesn't just exist in my childhood. This kind of missing the point is something I do every day. And I've frustrated people in my life, my whole life, because I can be so intelligent and so dumb. And people think that I'm taking the piss out of them. And so I used to hide my stupidity, and that meant that I just didn't talk a lot. And since being diagnosed, I began to just embrace my... I have a strange personality for people to comprehend, because I can be really cerebral and intellectual and philosophical, and then also an absolute child. And that is an autism thing. And it's really frustrating for people. And people think that you have a dual personality, or that you're manipulating, and, you know, to a certain extent. And what it is no, I don't know what's important. And I've since being diagnosed, I've learned to really enjoy that part of my personality and add a playfulness that's taken the shame out of it. And so that's a really fun story, but it's not one I gave any thought to, because it was shameful. And also it keeps happening. Like, that's not something that stopped when I was seven. That happened, yesterday.
The bit starts with the joke, I have high functioning autism, which is a terrible name for what I have, because it gives the impression that I function highly. Mm. I do not. Of the many things the net is about, one is sort of the rejection of self-deprecation by the marginalized, by those people who lack power. This joke is obviously different, but broadly it could be defined as self-deprecation and just sort of pure form of what is the joke. How did your thinking about it evolve in terms of how to use sort of the structure of self-deprecating differently and as you are post-Nanette?
My understanding of that joke is not that it's self-deprecating. I'm saying that, you know, the amount of work I have to do to exist in this world, my high functioning betrays that fact. It just says, you can manage. I'm like, that's all I can do. And that's less about me and more about how the world is structured and how we expect people to exist in the world. You know, like, the world is rigged against, you know, people who struggle with basic administration. You know, like, the world was impossible for me before stand-up comedy, because I didn't know how to get a job. I didn't know how to hold down a job. I didn't know how. I really struggled filling in basic forms. But I know how to do it. And if I sit down and focus, I can fill in a form. But that's then my whole day. And so you get to a point where all you're doing is the basic administration of life, and you're losing. So I don't think that that's self-deprecation. That's high functioning just means that I don't get to live my best life, because, God, you know, the world expects too much from individuals.
It's more a joke on the, you're right. It's more a joke about the,
yeah, look, the, honestly, if the I words. Was, if I was a man born in the 1950s, a middle-class man born in, I wouldn't have autism. I'd have a secretary, a wife, a mother, and I'd play golf and drink whiskey. I'd be fine. Like, they didn't do anything to keep themselves in the world. They didn't. Everything was done for them. And that's what I actually need. Basically Don Draper.
Yeah. You then go on to compare autism to feeling like being the only sober person in a room full of drunks, or the other way around. How did you come up with that analogy? What do you like about it?
At one stage I went further with that, because being undiagnosed means you're like the only sober person in a room full of drunks, and you don't understand that everyone is drunk. Mm-hmm. And that's been a really big part of my life, because that's when you start, you know, that's when you're performing. So you're watching how other people act, and then you go, this is how other people act. And so you do it, and it's always wrong, because you're watching And so the way you behave is not driven by how you feel. It's like, this is what people do in the world. And that's part of the reason I'm funny, because people are like, you're doing it slightly wrong. And it's either adorable or annoying, or, you know, in equal parts. And so that's the way I go. Yeah.
The story part follows a certain rhythm, which is your teacher tries to create a scenario with the box. No one has an answer. You then have an unexpected question in that moment. And then you, in your present day self, analyze your thinking and her reaction. You know, before Nanette, your work was very story heavy. When you have a story like this, how do you think about pacing it and structuring it? How do you think about the laughs and the points you're trying to get across?
You know, a story has its own sort of dynamic, and it's you know, it's always sort of, you've got to pull people forward so they think they know what they're expecting, and then there's got to be, you know, twists. And there's, you know, that one's got lovely rhythm because there's repetition. I love repetition. And I think also the one thing I love about that story is everyone kind of, that's not just autism, that's just learning about the world. And you know, because I can frame it as a child. There were stories I could have chosen where this happened in adulthood, and what I found is people didn't trust that as much, because I still think that people don't really believe me when I say I don't understand, and it can be unnerving for audiences. So the stories I tried with that one, you know, as an adult, people are like, this is not real. So I think, I had to choose one from my childhood in order to make it palatable. People look at my work and see me exist and go, you're not that stupid, stop pretending. But, you know.
In Nanette, you know, you focus part of the show on how you used to tell stories and how you'd remove the tough bits, which, beyond being sort of revelatory to your own personal experience, underlined how the stories comedians tell on stage as true are often not the whole truth. It's the part that when you tell in a sequence, are funny. Is this the story as it happened? Is it the parts that work on stage? I mean, like, what is your relationship to the truth of stories, especially as you so famously, I wouldn't say took it to task, but analyzed how you've had approached stories in the past?
Well, the subject matter of the Nanette was that, you know, the stories women could tell themselves and, you know, each other were different to what the world accepted. And it was that sort of disconnect between stage stories and the reality, and that causes pain. And that's where trauma exists, because, you know, your community refuses to listen to the reality that you just know is there. So that's, you know, that's the part of the story that's damaging. You know, victims of trauma can't escape their trauma because their community refuses to listen or doesn't have the framework to understand the story. So that's what that exists in. Whereas this story is not particularly traumatic. It's more sort of, in that sense, it's more sort of, you know, a connecting story. This is more of a universal story. So the flourishes, of course, are not, you know, it's not as it happened, but it is as it felt. And, you know, this story, I understand it, can exist in a framework that already exists in the world, whereas Nanette, I wrote Nanette pre-Me Too. In a post-Me Too world, it almost seems redundant. But, yeah, you know, it was part of that moment where it's just like, the world is gaslighting victims of sexual trauma.
As you said, the point of the story opposed to was the point of the story was to have it be a universal-seeming story, it seems, but to show how it was a little bit different, opposed to trying to show a more unique scenario that was more personal. Your goal was to find something people can connect to in a way that they can't connect to it, and as a way of showing on the margins of how this is what it was like if you were then me.
Yeah, look, because people think, people want, I still think people want autism to be a freak show. And that's what was driving that story. So it's like, it's not a freak show. It can be a freaky experience. But, you know, I think because we communicate wrong, so to speak, like to just boil it down to the crudest possible point, we communicate wrong, so therefore what we're trying to communicate is wrong. And I'm driven to try and challenge that. And it's like, no, how you communicate is important, but what you're communicating is also incredibly important. And I think, you know, I think if you refuse to adjust the way you communicate, you're in trouble. But also if people prioritize, you know, policing communication of like, I'm not listening to you because you said it wrong, I think that's a really dangerous place also. You know, like people who correct grammar or mock people because they don't spell a word right on social media, I just really think they're poisonous attitudes. It's just like you're calling someone dumb because, you know, maybe they didn't have the education you did, or maybe they aren't able to process the written word like you can. But what they're communicating, like if you refuse to listen to someone because, you know, they use the wrong there, you're an asshole. I come from a part of the world, you know, it's over, well over 50% of the people are illiterate. And that is just an investment in education. It is not a reflection of intelligence, you know, and that's a cycle. Poverty, and, you know, intergenerational trauma and all these things feed into that. And if you can't get over yourself and your, you know, grammar focus, you're dumb. You know, like, you know, I know I get my tone wrong all the time and I am constantly working on that. But, and that's part of the autism experience. But I see neurotypical people just being so tone deaf all the time. But because they, you know, neurotypical people have set the tone, it's fine. Mm-hmm. And I would like to see more of a, you know, push and pull on that.
The sort of peak of the joke, at least comedically, is when you ask your teacher, am I allowed to eat the box? which is, you know, a bit of a cheeky joke. That section, which is also part the you getting laughter and not knowing why, but you like it, and also the teacher not getting it. How did that section evolve, which is sort of like the comedic culmination of that?
Well, I mean, that's honestly how I got into comedy. Like, I always knew I was funny. I never understood why. And often people laugh at what I say and I have to understand it retroactively because I'm putting other pieces of a puzzle together, and during that process I say something. I'm trying to understand something, and sometimes I don't understand it in such a profoundly stupid way that it's funny. And then other times I put something together and I understand it in a really profoundly different way that helps people see the world differently. And those two things coexist. And that story is about, you know, I felt stupid in the moment, but now as an adult, because I never understood it, I kept striving to understand it. And now I can look back and I have ideas as to what goes into that. And one of the ideas is, like, you know, people who think they have the answer don't like getting asked the wrong question. You know, and that's not autism, that's the world, and that's about perspective.
It reminds me of this sort of later in the joke, you say you're contrasting with an earlier person, right? You say you were trying to learn. You didn't say propositions. I've never fucking heard of them, which was contrasting sort of seemingly neurotypical straight white men who refuse to learn even though they're capable of it. You know, it's when you're thinking of callbacks that are, do you think, like, can I use callbacks that are heightened as opposed to, like, let me just get more laughs in a moment when he laughs? How do you approach it? And we're like, oh, let me make sure I'm also sort of connecting it.
That's a really important callback, because I'm saying, like, I understand that frustration as well. Like, you know, I've never heard of something. You know, like, I'm in a way, like, I'm mocking, but I'm also connecting. It's like, I understand, you know, the frustration of not understanding but mm-hmm. I don't get to have that sort of anger. I don't get to have that, you know, luxury of being able to yell at the world.
Yeah. The joke ends, or at least the story ends, and you go, I understand if the penguin ate the box, the penguin would be around the box.
It's true.
Why? Tell me about what you like about that joke. Why end this sort of moment right here?
Because when that was something, because I still struggle to understand prepositions, and I was having a conversation with my producer, and that came out of that conversation. I'm like, because she's laughing at it, and I'm like, but still, you know, the penguin is around, you know, like I'm still to this day trying to understand the relationship between the penguin and the box. And I desperately want to understand who the penguin is. Who is this penguin? It also could be a caterpillar and an apple, I'm told.
Mm-hmm. You know, at the beginning of Douglas, you as you mentioned, you brilliantly sort of do these called forwards. You tell the audience everything they can expect the show. You sort of give them your outline for the show, to sort of run through it for those who haven't seen the show yet. Essentially, it's observational comedy, story one, which is the dog park story, story two, which is about your misdiagnosis, diagnosis, four, which is the hate baiting section, five is the joke section, six is tearing into the haters, new asshole section, which is a lecture. You do a lecture. Mm-hmm. Seven is like, I'm going to tell you I have autism. Then you go into anti-vaxxers. And then section nine, I'm going to let you in on my experience, a story involving a penguin, and then end with another lecture. Why have the story go right here in the show? What does it thematically mean, this is time, which is, you know, maybe like 50 minutes or so into the entire special?
Basically, I'm shaking. I'm completely shaking down Nanette. Because Nanette's like, it is based entirely on, here, let me get to know me with some gentle stories and how you expect me to be, and then surprise. Whereas Douglas is, no surprises, here's all the worst parts of the way I think and can behave in the world, and now I'm adorable. Mm-hmm. So it's really sort of, and that's autism, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I really make a good first impression. I can really be off-putting when people first meet me, but, you know, I do get there, and I am able to form relationships and people like me, and, you know, it's fine. But I just know that, you know, because I do it wrong.
You know, as I mentioned to that end, this is the sort of the third story of the show. Sort of all the stories are show a sort of failure to communicate in one way or the other. The first is sort of this man who's telling you to smile as a first way of talking to you. And then there's the uncomfortable conversation about your dog's name. The second is a doctor misdiagnosing you, which is largely due to certain misogyny. This story, which is also framed after you reveal your autism, you say things like, let me bring into my thinking here. Mm. You do a lot of like, and I was thinking this, and this is how I thought about that. What were you hoping for?
Well, that's how I've always had to communicate, because I've always had to just, you know, people are like, you said the wrong thing here. And for a long time I'd go, I just apologize and then try and understand. Whereas what I find is a really nice way of connecting with people now in my day-to-day life is like, you know that mistake I made? Let me bring him into my thinking. Mm-hmm. And I find it's been really helpful. It's like, oh, I'm sorry, I was prioritizing a different part, but this is why. And ultimately it's because I'm driven by the same desire, which is to connect. And it's the same as I'm talking about earlier. It's like people who punish you for the form of your communication, you know, stop looking for the reason of communication. And so, you know, I find by bringing people into my thinking, you know, I find it helpful. And I find it helpful when people share the way they think too. Like I really, really like that when people say, oh, these are the things I was, you know, driving at. And I'm like, that is fascinating. An emotion? You prioritized an emotion? Cool.
you know, as we were talking about, though it's not self-deprecating, you're sort of making, you're aware of sort of the incongruity of sort of how you're reacting to this normal situation and sort of making light into it. And you're showing the audience how to understand this person and embracing their sort of, I won't say faults or failings, but sort of inability to sort of act as expected. And in that way, to be sort of sentimental, it felt like falling in love, especially because you describe The Hour as a romantic comedy. When did you realize that? How would you describe the love?
But that's how I've always kind of felt when I've had a good show. You know, it's like I felt understood. And that's really, I think, what I understand is love, is being understood. You know, I hate falling in love, that part of it, that uncertainty of it, I hate. But I do love being understood, and I love understanding others, and that's, for me, is what drives my work.
Does a part of it come out of the experience of doing this show, Nanette, where you thought it was going to sort of push you further away from people, it was going to push you in the boundaries, and the opposite happened, where you embraced it at such a remarkable, massive scale? Is it partly sort of you coming to terms with that sort of outpouring, that tremendous outpouring of this sort of more complicated version of you that you put out for the first time?
Yeah, that was incredible. I'm still struggling to really process that. You know, and that's a really important part of how I understand recovery from trauma, you know, because writing that show was, you know, one level of catharsis, but really it was the reception of the show that did the healing for me, to help me escape the trauma loop. Because I think, you know, basically trauma and shame exist in this thing where you feel unsafe in your community, whatever. You know, we don't always know why. And having, you know, that reception meant that it was like, oh, I feel safer in my community, because people are like, that's not just a you thing. And when you feel isolated, you know, and trauma tends to isolate you, you know, that's incredible. It's impossible for everyone to do that. Like, I don't think I've discovered a recipe for overcoming trauma. Yeah. Like, you can't do what I mean, I wouldn't recommend it either. It was it was a lot. But I do think there's something to be found in, you know, trauma isn't, there's no solution. There's just sort of helping.
Yeah. Of the many things that were sort of unique to the perspective you brought to Nanette is, you know, especially around interviews you did around it, was sort of you argued against the primacy of laughter in comedy, that people can kind of get laughs anywhere, that an hour of laughs might be boring, where you sort of have to give them more. You pointed about how people will laugh in audiences even if they don't think things are funny. They might laugh just to feel safe. Mm-hmm. You know, if they feel unsafe and they just want to laugh just to fit in. So, you know, and with Nanette, you question with the idea of giving people laughter to offer them release. You know, this special obviously is tonally different. You did it knowing that most people have probably already seen Nanette. You call it fun. You say you're having fun. How has your relationship to laughter and your audience evolved after putting yourself out there to the degree you did with Nanette and having it be embraced as it did? You know, what is your relationship to those sort of laugh aspects?
I mean, laughter serves a purpose of catharsis. And, you know, Nanette was, you know, I lanced a boil, to use really lovely language and metaphor. And so, you know, there's, you know, Douglas exists in a post-cathartic world for me, but also that, but I don't think that changes what I said in that. I think, you know, for individual performers, like if you're, you know, if you're circling around something that's actually destructive for you for the sake of a joke, I don't think that's helpful for an audience or you. Like, I think every individual performer, you know, if anything, I just hope, you know, I've given a little bit of wriggle room for other people to tell their stories in a more constructive way. I like jokes. Like, I think they're a really great way to make people feel comfortable. You know, as much as they're a great way to make people feel uncomfortable.
When you say that, it reminds me that I feel like some people, when Nanette came out, were like, oh, she hates comedy, she wants to destroy comedy. And, you know, hearing you talk about jokes, it's, to me, when I saw it, it's like, this is a person who loves comedy. She expects so much of it that she's doing this show.
It's a lifeline. It's been a lifeline for me. So, you know, without comedy, I wouldn't have built up the confidence to quit comedy.
You have a background in art history, and you did a show in Australia analyzing the idea of the fine art canon. As you know, comedy as we conceive it is an incredibly new art form. Nanette was made clearly out of frustration with comedy and who gets opportunities and who gets lionized. In the States, her special's coming out on Netflix soon after Jerry Seinfeld's. Louis C.K., the biggest comedian when you started working on Nanette, sort of is now not on Netflix. He self-released his special. Sort of considering all of this, you know, what does it mean for you for capital C comedy to not only make room for someone like you, to sort of have you be given its largest platforms?
It's pretty fucked up, isn't it? Like, I don't know. That's a head spin. The landscape's changing. I'm still struggling to understand it. You know, when I first started, if you got a spot on TV, like that was the only way people could access you beyond the live component. The internet has changed that. And also it's changed why people seek out comedy. They don't seek it out because they need funny content. That's everywhere now. If you want to, like, everyone is funny on the internet. Like, it's all there. So in a way, it's sort of freed up the art form from providing this one particular service. And I don't feel threatened by that. I feel, like, invigorated by it because it's sort of like, you know, and this pandemic is so interesting because it's destroyed live comedy in the moment. You know, you can't, and that's what it is. It's being in a room full of people laughing is special. We don't do that. You know, like there was a time in the way society was structured when actually people every weekend would, you know, all people in a community would go to a church and sit together and, you know, think about the same things at the same time. And that doesn't happen anymore. And live comedy was one of the very few places where I think that could happen in such a splintered world. So it's a really fascinating space at the moment.
Yeah.
I went off on one there. I ended up in a different place we started. Sorry.
No, it's okay. That was going to be my next question anyway, so it's fine. I was going to ask you about how this has been, considering that, you know, you've just gone through sort of this period of extreme feelings of disconnection to this extreme feelings of connection and realizing the power of it, and then now seeing what it sort of exists on this grand scale, the inability for people to have it. How's it made you think about audiences? I don't know if you're thinking like, oh, I was going to take a break, I've done these specials, I'm trying to get out of the pace. Has it made you sort of hungry for it?
No, I'm tired. I'm really
okay.
You know, I'm in a very fortunate position in that, you know, I was able to film this special before the world shut down, and I toured, and you know, I have a bit of coin in the bank to be reasonably comfortable. So I needed a break. I'm exhausted. I was exhausted after Nanette, and then doing this show was the only way I knew how to process what had happened with Nanette. But I reached a level of exhaustion that's sort of kind of dangerous for someone with a brain like mine. So I'm sleeping a lot and recovering. So my concern is not for myself. It's, you know, I'm sleep, you know, I don't need to see people for a long time. But I am concerned about, you know, jobbing comedians and how this affects people, the way that, you know, interact with, you know, what comedy is and what it can be. I think it could be an exciting time, but you've got to be careful with that because, you know, something like this causes a huge amount of stress. And stress is a killer. And so, you know, it's one thing for me to say, oh, comedy, this could be a growth period. It's just like, nah, people are stressed because life is stressful. This is frightening. And, you know, I think only time's going to tell on this as what it does. But people, you know, creativity is a way of coping with stress. So I think, you know, I think we will see, you know, different ways of content creation. I've, you know, for a moment there, I thought, oh, maybe I should be creating content to help people. And then I'm like, oh, well, A, I'm tired. And also, you know, this is where I've got a voice. I've got a platform. I'm okay. I don't need to flood the world with my voice, particularly because my voice, I'm, for a fucking miracle, I'm comfortable for the first time in my life in a moment where a lot of people are really uncomfortable and that's really weird. But it's from those, I think the interesting voices from this are going to emerge from people who are struggling and are going to demand their creativity overcome what's happening to them at the moment. So I'm excited, you know, I really hope that some really interesting, positive and constructive voices find their way through this and it could transform what comedy is.
You describe genius as not a person but an event in an interview once, and I it stuck with me because I think it's really interesting. It's really brilliant. You know, or even in Annette, you say artists don't create the zeitgeist, they respond to it. But, you know, having lived through it, having sort of processed this all, and having some time to sort of reflect right now, as people call that work genius, who call your work generally a genius, do you have a sense about why you were the person that filled the void of that genius at the time? You know, like, not saying it's you, but like, why was the your talent shaped thing the thing that was the thing? Does that make sense?
Yeah, look, I've thought about it at, you know, various points, and I like to contextualize things. And I think, you know, it's guesswork at best, but I think part of what it was an authenticity of voice that could only come from someone who was like, appeared to come from nowhere.
Yeah.
I think, you know, like, and because the very nature of the show is, it's like, I literally do not care about my reputation or yours. And that's why it worked. I'm in a different place now. I can't create a work like that anymore. People look at me different. People expect different things from me. So, you know, that's why it's a moment, not me. Mm-hmm. Like, I was part of that moment and I did a lot of the heavy lifting, don't get me wrong. But, you know, history is littered with women who did brilliant work and no one took any notice of it. And are they geniuses? I'd like to think so, but we'll never know.
You know, in various conversations, I've heard you sort of push back on ideas of legacy, of the idea of a person leaving a mark or aspiring to leaving a mark. You once said people shouldn't aspire to greatness. They should try to inspire. You know, you've talked about how sort of power has the ability to sort of corrupt people. This was all before you knew that you were going to be given a platform. And I think, as you're aware, given power, what is it like to be in it, and how have you, while you're making your work, being like, how do you sort of, I was going to say put your money where your mouth is, but that's almost literally too literal. How have you reconciled that point of view you had with this position you're in?
Well, it doesn't change my position. I think, you know, for a start, like, I make sure that I take risks, you know, and I'm not here going, I need to be in, increase my position. You know, I need to get more famous and have more, you know, like I think I focus very much on my work and go, if this doesn't land, then it's, I've read the room wrong. And, but I'm always trying to, you make sure, you know, I focused on Douglas as a piece, not like what it would do to the world's understanding of me and my position in it. And also I think I still stand by that. I think, you know, that Nanette happened is great, you know, and, you know, for all sorts of reasons. And, but if people take Nanette and then stand around it and protect it, you know, then what, I just don't think that's the healthy bit. And I'm certainly not going to stand around Nanette and go, you can't say anything bad about it. Like, because, you know, man, like I like evolution, not revolution, you know? And by protecting a piece of work, it means you take the breath out of it. You know, my work now, if it does any good, it does good because people have a conversation with it. They pick it up and take it elsewhere. And I honestly think that's where the focus should be. Like, I'm happy for this little purple patch, but it's not the point. It's just so that, you know, like, you know, that's the point of, you know, when I studied the history of art, it wasn't like, it's like this idea led to this idea led to this idea. And it wasn't just in a vacuum. It was because the world demanded different things. And we learned from like, oh, you know, this is not a great way to view the world, but it was important in the time. And so it's that sort of like understanding history is not the same as elevating it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so many people have done so many great things and just disappeared into a void. And that's just how it happens. Like, and I think, you know, like I look at, you know, like Louis C.K. is not handling his current moment well. So, you know, for various reasons. So I've looked at it and I'm going, well, I hope that I can handle a recession of my relevance better. So I'm kind of driven by that. It's like, yeah, I hope I'm not relevant soon. I can't speak for the world.
So that sound means it's time for a final segment. It's called the Laughing Round. It's like a lightning round, but because it's comedy, it's a laughing round.
Okay.
Thank you.
I hope it is laughing.
Do you have a sort of joke you like, a street joke, a kid's joke, a dad joke that you just like, a regular old joke you like?
Oh man, I do. And I've just forgotten it. It just ran away from my brain. Hang on. Oh man, what's my joke? Oh, it's not a kid's joke. It's like, what's the worst thing you can hear when giving Willie Nelson a blowjob?
What?
I'm not Willie Nelson.
I do like that one.
Is he dead? He hasn't died, has he?
No, he is not.
Oh, thank God.
No, I think he just did a tribute of some sort. Or
no, it was Kenny Rogers, wasn't it?
Yes.
All right.
Yes. Is there a joke or anything another comedian has done in their set that you wish you could steal, but not sort of steal, but like it's another dimension where everything's exactly the same, but you have this person's joke? Or it's just sort of you saw a joke and you're like, oh, I wish I thought of that.
No.
That's okay. You could pass. I forgot. You're allowed to pass.
Thank you. No, I have a weird relationship with comedy.
The Ninja Turtles play a part in Douglas. Can you rank the Ninja Turtles by how much you like the art of their namesake?
Raphael is at the bottom, dull as dishwater. I like Michelangelo. He's okay, but he's third. Then we have Leonardo da Vinci. He's pretty good, but he didn't finish. Fuck, you know, nothing he did. He's finished. It's incredible to me that people build conspiracy theories about he's trying to communicate this. Was he? We don't know. He didn't finish. And then I love Donatello. But I also like proto-Renaissance more than I like Renaissance.
That is, for people who've seen the special, that is a very ironic choice. Taylor Swift comes up in your act a few times. You've listened to a lot of her. You said you studied Taylor Swift. Do you have a favorite Taylor Swift song?
No, okay. I don't. She defies my logic. She's been I want to understand her and her songs, and all I see is a personality disorder that could get me in trouble.
Sure.
Oh well.
Do you have other names? If someone's listening who's considering getting a dog soon, do you have other names for dogs you might recommend?
A friend of mine just got a dog and called it Sprocket, which I quite like. That's it. It's a Jim Henson reference. Sprocket. It's a good one. But no, I'm terrible at dog names.
The special starts with a lot of things you've observed about America, or an amount. Are there other things that didn't make it in, just sort of other curiosities that you still have lingering?
Oh, they are unfolding. You guys are not doing well. I am at a loss. What have you done?
Last one. Let's. Do you have a joke or a story that you've told a bunch of times that you really think is really good, that you think is very funny, but it has never sort of connected to the audiences the way that you think they should, maybe to the point you've given it up, or maybe to a point where you're like, let me sit on that a bit and revisit another time later?
For the last four of my shows that I've written, I had this bit about Adam and Eve, and it just won't. It lives for a little while in the show and then always drops out. And it's to do with, one day I'm going to make this work.
What is the general area, could you say?
Well, I try and reframe the story, trying to rewrite Bible, basically. Maybe that's my problem. I try and defend the story of Adam and Eve from atheists, the arrogance of atheists.
Got it.
I'm an atheist, by the way. That's why it's probably a difficult sell.
That's it. That's the end of the interview. Thank you so much for doing it. It means so much that you gave me all this time. Thank you so much for your answers and your time. That's it for another episode of Good One. You can stream Douglas on Netflix. Follow Hannah on social media at Hannah Gadsby. Good One is produced by myself, Jelani Carter, Art Chong, and Camila Salazar. Gautam Srikishan did our theme song. Write a review and rate the show on Apple Podcasts. 5 stars, please. Email any comments, questions, or laughing around suggestions to goodonepodcast@gmail.com or tweet at us at goodonepodcast. I'm Jesse David Fox, and you can follow me at Jesse David Fox. Good One is a production of Vulture and the Vox Media Podcast Network. We'll be back next week with Judd Apatow. Have a good one.
What does it take to be an entrepreneur, and how is it changing in our ever-evolving business landscape? This is Scott Galloway, host of the Prop G Podcast and an entrepreneur myself. Right now, we've got a special 3-part series running all about the future of entrepreneurship. We're answering your questions on work-life balance, how to raise capital for your business, and more. Because when you're an entrepreneur, it's always important to look ahead at what's to come. So tune in to the Future of Entrepreneurship, a Prop G Pod special sponsored by Mercury. You can find it on the Prop G Pod feed or wherever you get your podcasts.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.